Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the New Books in Japanese Studies, a channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Rantz Wagenberg, a historian of Japan at Penn State. Today, I'll be talking to Jennifer Pro about her book, Kyoto Revisited, Heritage Tourism in Contemporary Japan, which came out with Hawaii this year, 2022. With me today also is Dr. Danielle Milne of Kyoto University, who is coordinating with me our own project on Kyoto heritage and history. Kyoto Revisited looks at the uses and effects of heritage in tourism in Kyoto today, seen through city policy and advertising, hotel infrastructure and tour guiding, season-based events, tourism to sites connected to Bakumatsu period hero Sakamoto Ryoma, and the phenomena of walking in rental kimono around the city. Emphasizing the ways experience-based tourism has been transforming Kyoto's tourist landscape, Pro examines how heritage has been understood, marketed, and experienced with both the tourist industry and domestic and international tourists. Through interviewing long-term tour guides and revealing the traces of past tourism forms in hotels and other tourist infrastructure, among other methodologies, Kyoto Revisited explored the local impact of global and national shifts in tourism on Kyoto's domestic and international tourism industry from about the 1970s to the COVID era. Incidentally, Pro's period of fieldwork neatly overlapped with the rapid escalation of foreign tourist numbers to the city with growing calls to address over-tourism, but also the current crisis in tourism with Japan close to tourists. The book does provide important insight into Kyoto during the decades of the biggest transition in international tourism to the city in the last half century. Kyoto Revisited does demonstrate not only how the past has been used to construct the city's identity and shape understanding of Japan for travelers, but also how these speak to broader trends in our contemporary moments. Good evening and good morning, both of you.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for having me here, Ren.
Yes, and good evening. It's lovely to be here joining you tonight.
Stuck in our different time zones. I might ask the first question, Jen. The timing of your book, the period that you cover is, I think, really important. You've got this very significant turning period in tourism to Japan and to Kyoto. What brought you to this research topic just at the start of this important turning point in Kyoto's tourism?
Yeah, I wish I could say that I was prescient and I saw this all coming. The project came up and that's when I got the grant. And actually, when I started this research, it was January of 2012. So it felt like at that moment, the worst time to start studying tourism because it was not quite a year after the earthquake and tsunami of March 2011. So actually, when I arrived to start studying tourism in Kyoto, all the numbers were down and had been for almost 9 months. And over that first 8 months of my field work, they picked up gradually by the summer. By the time I left, they had picked up. But when I started, it felt like the worst moment to study tourism in Kyoto. And then my book went to press right after we had all closed for 2020. So it almost immediately became a historical document encapsulating this boom that happened in that decade. The recovery happened pretty quickly. I mean, by 2013, Tokyo had been announced as the next Olympic site, and really the city was starting to prepare for that. I think maybe research is always this way. It feels like anthropology is this way. It's part planning and part serendipity. So that's mostly how it happened. But the tourism numbers just increased dramatically between 2012, really by the end of 2012, and until Japan closed in 2020.
And as we're recording today, actually, tourism has came back to Japan, right? It's a serendipitous day, I guess.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's open for the first time to tourists since, April of 2020. I mean, you could go, I think, if you were a part of a set tour that had government approval, but visas, airports are open as of today. So, yes, here we are.
So I want to ask you, I just want to go right into the maybe theoretical heart or some of the important questions the book raised, which are about heritage. It's something that incidentally both me and Daniel are working on, but from the historical angle. So I want to start with a quote. You argue in the book that heritage have multiple meanings. Those meanings are created, you say, as interested parties, state and local, public and private, tell different stories about the past, which are marketed in response to tourist desires, for face-to-face engagement in what you call an experience economy. Now, there's a lot to unpack here. First and foremost, the role of experience, but I want to focus here on heritage. Some, though not most researchers, will take issue with this emphasis on commodified heritage or experience and ways created. Can you maybe expand on this? Isn't Kyoto really the heart of Japan?
Yeah, this is such a great question to start with. This is one of the central tensions that I really tried to address and struggled with in the book. I think my answer is kind of yes and. On the one hand, I think Kyoto is, in some ways, seen as, understood as the heart of Japan. It was the capital from 794 until 1868. And even as the seat of power shifted, it has the imperial household and all the accoutrements and traditional crafts that go with that. Most of the religious institutions have their headquarters there. It wasn't firebombed in World War II, and so it kept more of its old feel than certainly Tokyo, and the city's attended to historic preservation districts all along. So it is a charming city with views of the hills, and I think people respond to it. So there is some, I guess I would say, real heritage there. One of the things that has been surprising about this research is that when I've given talks about it, even scholars and other researchers will come up to me afterwards and tell me about their favorite thing about Kyoto. So there is this kind of charm or appeal to the city. And I think that's very real. On the other hand, some of these very same features have been commodified, which doesn't mean that they're all fake, but they have been marketed or put to other use or packaged for tourists and tourist experiences. And of course, there are some things that get added along the way, constructed or recreated. I really think both those things are true, and that's one of the tensions I'm trying to play with in the book. I do resist some of the language of, in a lot of tourism books that you'll hear, Kyoto's become a museum to itself, or it's almost become a theme park of heritage. And I resist that extremity as well, while trying to keep all those things in tension. And one of the ways that I wanted to focus on all those different parties, local officials, businesses, tourists themselves, locals themselves, is because I think all of those things, those the heritage is important to all those groups in somewhat similar ways and in different ways. So I was trying to keep all those things in balance throughout the chapters as I was looking at things. So I think my line there is yes, and it there is heritage there and it's commodified, and that's a part of what's happened, particularly in this moment.
So yeah, That's it for us as people who have been living and coming away from Germany for a long time. Is the language that is used, especially by all those interested parties, of course, it's very, how should I put it? it's designed to push buttons, which it's very easy to see as cynical and commodified and you know, aiming at listing emotions that we're kind of a little bit more comfortable with, like Orientalism and the like, right?
Sorry.
Go ahead, yeah.
I think that's true. One of the things that I was really struck by was, and tried to think about, was the way that while Japanese domestic tourists and international tourists obviously have really different relationships to Kyoto, they also travel to Kyoto for some of the same reasons. So I would talk to Japanese tourists who would say, well, when we travel, we don't do this anywhere else, but when we travel to Kyoto, we always stay in a ryokan and we wear yukata and there is a way in which, of course, not all, but many domestic tourists also travel to Kyoto for some of those same reasons. That maybe aren't Orientalism, but a different kind of approach to their own heritage. And in both senses, it's romantic, I think, or romanticized in the marketing of it, right?
Yes.
Yeah, actually, when I came back to, I just came back to Japan last week, I got on a Hankyu train from Osaka and I got on the Kyoto train. I'd never been on the Kyoto train before. To train inside, in the seats, they're all tatami seats with sort of tatami backings. And they have gardens, you know, little rock gardens within the train. Noren at the entrance to each carriage. Really amazing thing. And you can see that all these people coming from Osaka, from different parts of Kansai, are coming up on that train. You know, it's part of the experience of this transition to their own past or their idea of their own past. It was fascinating. I might switch now, though, to experience. It's, of course, connected. I was really interested in the change that you show in your book. And you discuss the transition in tourism through seeing. Miru, you talk about it, that you use the Japanese terms here, encountering, fureru, and the experiencing, or taiken. Can you tell us about how these can be seen in Kyoto and also the significance of the Japanese concepts? Why are these important too?
Yeah, the terms. So one of the things I like about those terms is that we think about the ways you can see different layers of history in Kyoto. You can encounter markers to different moments in history, but these are kind of marking different eras of tourism, although they all still happen now to some extent. And the terms themselves came up in interviews with longtime tour guides or people in shops that I talked to and in some of the city's documents as well. And so if we think about seeing tourism or miru tourism, you think about mass tourism, people on buses driving to a famous site and hearing something about the city along the way, and then they all get out and see it and take a picture. You were traveling to see something famous. And so you might think about all of the ways we can think about mass tourism and the way that that gets packaged. And you can see those layers in the city, right? So around particular sites, there always has to be a parking lot out of the way, out of sight, but for the big buses. And so you can see this and feel this if you're attentive in the city. Where are big souvenir centers near places where lots of people are going? So the city gets shaped by this kind of tourism as well, or we can see the remnants of it. Even places like Gion Corner, which is a place to experience some Maiko or Geisha traditions, or the Nishijin Textile Center. Those are both traditional craft areas that are made for tour buses, basically, to come to show larger groups of tourism. So that is an earlier era of tourism, but it's also still a part of the city today. The tour guides I talked to, Fureyao or Fureru, came up as encountering, and it was always identified, and this came up in several interviews, as this moment in the 90s when Lonely Planet came out. And people would say things like, all of a sudden there were foreigners wandering around in some district where they never used to go, right? So you had this guide and you could find your own way. So they would talk about this as a different moment in Kyoto's tourism. And another example would be the way tourist information centers worked. So the big tourism information center that was right across from Kyoto Station for a long time was very scripted and made for mass tourism. And in the 90s, you started to be able to, if you couldn't speak Japanese, you could connect with a staff person there who would help you call and make your hotel reservation. So there were starting to be ways in which you could find your own way in Kyoto a little bit. And the goal there was to get off the beaten path and to explore and see local culture a little bit more. But so many of the guides, and especially people who have been involved in tourism for a long time, would always talk about that as a different moment when people started wandering around and trying to find their own way in the 90s. So clearly mass tourism is much easier for the city to manage, right? We need some parking lots and we have to kind of hide them, but it's much harder to manage once people are trying to find their own way. And then part of what I'm arguing is Taiken is the new turn. So it's also finding your own way, but it's looking for much stronger experiences. So not just a little encounter with local life, but more experiences like walking around in kimono or yukata, or cooking classes or traditional craft classes. And you can see all of that in contemporary Kyoto as well. So you can see all of these layers, but there's a move to Taiken now. And you see that in some of the city documents as well, and the kinds of experiences that different places are trying to market or advertise. And it's not particular to Kyoto. The turn to experiential tourism, I think, is happening more globally. Airbnb, for example, in the last, just before COVID, had added experiences to their website. And so you can sign up for local experiences. So I think that's a broader trend sort of globally, but this is the way we can see it happening in Kyoto in particular.
Kyoto, like the Taiken, the experience part, actually is pretty fascinating as for people who we're not used to it. I wouldn't walk around in kimono. I wouldn't walk around with kimono, and I guess because it's really not experiencing. I would say not experience how people live, but how you. Because no one in Kyoto, no regular quote unquote Kyotoites walk around in kimono, right? And I hope my mom or my wife don't listen to this, but you know, when my mom was in Kyoto and she walked around this corner in Gion, she would want to take pictures of all those Maiko, and I kept wanting to tell her that those are not real Maiko, they're not real geisha, and my wife's like, don't tell her. It's fine, don't tell her. and she was very happy. But you know, in my mind, of course, this is not real Taiken. This is a form of cosplay in a way, right? A form of cosplay. And that's I think this is how you frame it, right? It's something similar to historical reenactment in a way, if you take it a little bit more seriously. But it's also something unique about it. I think you said it exists other places, but I think Kyoto in particular. And specifically with, and I want to hear your opinion, but I think specifically with Asian visitors, because one of the main ways that I could tell that those people in kimono are not real geisha is that they spoke Chinese. So why is it so popular with Chinese, and what's about kimono and Kyoto? What is this connection here that you see, that I see? Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good question. I kept wanting to, especially in the chapter about kimono rental, I was like, I got to come up with the reason why Asian tourists in particular are in kimono. And one of the problems with doing maybe contemporary or in situ immediate research is that we might just need more time before we know that exactly. But it was interesting because when I was interviewing in 2012, everybody I talked to, they were like, well, we're trying to increase tourism, but Chinese tourists are just not interested in Kyoto. They like Osaka for shopping and they like Tokyo, but they have beautiful nature and temples in China. So they don't need to come to Kyoto. I heard that over and over and over again. And then, and then the Chinese tourism boom happened, right? So Chinese tourists, it turns out, do really like Kyoto and they like going to the temples and shrines. This taiken of wearing kimono really took off with that group. In the book, I compare it to cosplay and historical reenactment, mostly because I was trying to think about what are something we could compare this to as a way to analyze this thing that was sort of happening in the moment. And I think it is different than both of those examples. Both of those examples, cosplay and historical and reenactment, have a kind of story or a narrative that you're playing out, even if it's not exactly, or in cosplay, you might be in character and not acting out a story, but there is some kind of narrative there. And that's not happening in kimono rental. As you say, nobody's playing out a movie. It's just putting on a version of the Japanese traditional dress and trying to walk around in the heritage district. So it is embodied, but it's not reenacting history or playing out any kind of narrative. And in that way, it's definitely touristic practice and much thinner. The other thing that I think is clear about it is that it's largely about the experience of walking around in the heritage district and feeling the heritage in some ways, but it's also about taking good selfies or pictures of yourself in kimono with the beautiful traditional background. And in the overtourism, in the peak of conversations about overtourism before Japan closed, that Instagram curating of tours was a big thing that kept coming up. The way that people were curating their tours from social media, and that was especially disruptive to have everybody wanting to pose in front of the same thing. So I think that did become a part of the problem. I wish I had a great answer as to exactly why. I would argue that I would speculate at least that for Asian tourists in particular, dressing up in kimono and walking in the heritage district is a way to experience Japanese culture that's very distanced from anything that would be politically touchy or any remnant of World War II or any national tensions at all, right? This is a romanticized, again, version of Japan, seeing people in kimono and walking on cobblestones, shopping in the wooden areas. And so it's a kind of safe, fun form of Japanese tourism, I would argue.
Yeah, even though there was a case in... Did you hear about a case in China about a week ago, was Daniel? I think you sent me the...
The case that you're talking about there, I think, ran is a Chinese woman walking around in her hometown and wearing kimono and being arrested by a policeman who was yelling at her, you know, you're Chinese, you shouldn't be wearing these Japanese clothes. Is that the case you're talking about, Ran?
Yeah, I am. So that maybe this apolitical nature of it might change because China is changing also rapidly. And we didn't have any Chinese tourists for the last 2 years, and nor will we have for the next, at least, I don't know how long, right?
True, true. There's another case of, I think you sent me a link about this Chinese shopping center that was a Kyoto themed shopping center, and they eventually canned it. They eventually shifted it to your typical shopping center, I guess, with your Gucci and those typical things. So perhaps there's some change within China as well in that regard, as relations with Japan shift and change. The way people think about kimono and Kyoto shifts and change as well, becomes more or less political.
Can I ask you something also about kimono? Because we talk mostly about Chinese tourists. I was told, and you and I maybe is just anecdotal, by a Zainichi, Japanese-Korean friend, that those Chinese people can wear kimono, but we Koreans will never walk around in kimono. Is this rings true to you, that Korean tourists do not wear kimono?
I think that it's less frequent, but at least when I was interviewing at the kimono rental shops, they said it was popular among Asian tourists broadly. And I certainly have seen I've seen Korean women in kimono taking pictures. I mean, you know, because I don't speak Korean or Chinese, but I can distinguish them. So I wouldn't say never, but I mean, I've seen it. I think it was popular amongst Korean tourists. You can do similar sort of dress-ups in Seoul with traditional Korean dress as well. So that form of tourism, I think, is popular more broadly in Asia, as the China examples.
Yeah, I guess as scholars, we're sometimes looking for things under the surface, and maybe they're not there. But I want to stay on the historical tensions theme and talk and go from kimono to your chapter on Ryoma. Was a lot of fun to read. It's like another, yeah, every time I tell people, Japanese people, that I do, that I work also in Kyoto, they immediately ask about Ryoma, which I find quite funny. I tell them, so in your chapter, you focus on two sites, Teradaya-in, right, in Fushimi, where he was murdered, and then there's a shrine dedicated to him, Kyoto Ryozan Goku Shrine. Now, as my work on Kyoto, the work that I do is focusing on military history and heritage in Kyoto, which is, of course, something which is mostly a pre-war subject. Now, those two sites stood out for me immediately because Fushimi was and still is chock full of military imperialist sites. And you think about the Meiji Emperor Museum on Momoyama, and there's the Nobi Shrine right there, right? And then there's the former site of 6th Division, which was heavily involved in the King Massacre, which is now university site. And the Goku Shrine in particular is, I can call it a nationalist Disneyland in a way, because you have statues of kamikaze and memorial for Rabin Harpal and so on. So I wonder if any, you see those two phenomena interacting, or is just completely separated? Because what I think is here is maybe Taiken or experience here is also a form of unseeing those less savory aspects of the past. And I think...
Yeah, I like that. I mean, I ended up at Fushimi just because, again, everything seems like happenstance, but Ryoma Den came out. And so I was following Ryoma tourism and seeing where you could buy these books that were like, go here to see where he was. And so I was looking for the places where lots of tourists were looking at Ryoma sites. And I didn't actually know a lot about the Fushimi area until this field work, and was surprised by how many different, I would also say, nationalist sites there are in that area. I just didn't end up, there were lots of things that I was like, I could have a chapter on this and I could have a chapter on that. And I didn't end up writing about it. But I do think, you know, some of these things, I mean, Ryoma's story is attractive because he's a hero and he's part samurai and part modern. And he's been played up in so much media that he's just really popular. I don't know if I would say that Taiken is directly a way of unseeing, like that's its goal, but there is a definite erasure of the more negative sides of tourism available in Kyoto. You don't see any of those sites on any of the main web pages, or of course history buffs, people who are looking for that can find it, right? And you can go to the Goku Shrine, and lots of people do, but it's definitely, none of that part of the history is played up in even some of the domestic tourism books, right?
Yeah, of course. I mean, it's not intentional, but I'm not saying that they're doing it to conceal or something like this, but there are sometimes intentional, like Daniel, you work on Mimizuka, for example, like the ear and nose mound, right? This is intentionally concealed, right?
Absolutely.
In a way, because it doesn't have the English signage and things for it, it's concealed in that way, and obviously doesn't get a lot of visitors. I'd say the same for a lot of for Gokoku Shrine as well, and next to Gokoku Shrine is another place that I look at, Ryozen Kanon. But I think it's and that is a World War II heritage, World War II memorial temple, a temple for memorializing World War II dead. But I think as you're saying there, Jen, there's it's partly just because there's not many people visiting it, and perhaps that's a reflection of what people are interested in about Kyoto. They're not interested in modern Japan, and that maybe shifts back to Rand's question of why that is and if there's something being concealed there. So what do you think about that? I mean, the more general idea of Kyoto and why people are interested in the city.
Yeah, I mean, that wouldn't fit in with the heritage story that's being told, right? Those perhaps more modern moments, even though there's, you know, Kyoto Station is not traditional, right? There are lots of modern buildings in Kyoto. But the heritage that's being promoted and I think that most domestic tourists as well go for is a different kind of heritage than that, for sure. I think many of those sites are obscured, certainly for international tourists, right? They're just not translated, and they're not, you can find them because you can Google anything, but you're going to have to do some translating yourself. And they're just not the kinds of sites that are promoted, especially to international tourists. The thing that stood out to me the most when I was there was the area south of the station that has typically been associated with Korean communities or Buraku. The city has had a lot of trouble. They kept wanting to expand there because there's more space, and they've had a lot of trouble doing that. Not a lot of businesses will move down there. There's still a lot of stigma, but tourists, especially international tourists, are just totally oblivious to all of that. So Nintendo moved down there as a way to try and promote that this is an okay area as well, and they've put up some hotels. But that's another area where I think you've got some competing narratives, and international tourists in particular are just totally unaware of it. It's not easily available in any of the information. So certainly there's erasure of the negative aspects, and send, even though we don't want too many tourists in the famous places, keeping them in the safe, narrow, central, curated part of the city is more attractive to, you know, city officials, and it's easier to keep things in check.
Yeah, and you know, we have people in our project work on Gojoraku and the red light district, which is slightly north and east of the area you're talking about, which was a former Buraku area. There's a Yakuza headquarters there, but it's marvelous and Nintendo, gorgeous.
And Nintendo's headquarters too, right?
Yeah, the old Nintendo headquarters. Yeah. I mean, so people will go to see the Nintendo headquarters, but they're completely oblivious to I mean, for me, this is fascinating, right? You can walk through those areas that have such a charged history, but you're totally oblivious because you are kind of go to where the tourist books and the guys are telling you. On what you said before about why people go to Kyoto also, it's a thing because, again, there's some kind of division of labor. Tokyo is the modern, right? People go to Tokyo for modernity, they go to Kyoto for a tradition, go to Hiroshima for, I don't know why, because my work is originally in Hiroshima, and then people come to Hiroshima and they're not sure what they want to see, right? There's not much to see. So, yeah, so I guess those meta-narratives are kind of dominating all three.
So one really interesting part of your book was your focus on the transition, as you described before, and how it's reflected in the guides, who have been working for, you know, some of them for 50 years or so or more, but also in the hotels. I really found anyway that looking at the history of tourism through architecture of hotels quite interesting. Could you explain more about it, Jen?
Yeah, yeah. The main example that I have in the book is the Miyako Hotel, which is now the Miyako Sheraton, and it's the second oldest Western style hotel in Kyoto. And I just happened to the father of a child who was in class with my son was the manager there. So I got a couple of tours, and I was surprised that it's a big rambling hotel kind of near the Heian Shrine. And so he took me into some of the areas. And he said, basically, this hallway, and it wasn't remodeled very well, hadn't been redone recently, but he said, this hallway essentially fits a busload of tourists and two drivers. And it was, this wing was built for the Osaka Bampaku in 1970. And so he was showing different parts of the hotel. It's also got a little traditional house right in the middle that you can stay in as well. And the imperial family, the Showa Emperor, loved that hotel and always stayed there and had a suite on the corner overlooking the torii for the Heian Jingu. And so it was that was a really insightful tour because he knew so much about the history of the building. But that made me think about other hotels. There's so many Japanese business hotels and the Shugaku Ryoko or school trips. There's so many hotels that have just enough space for a bus of students, and their cafeterias are designed for, and they can host other people, but they're designed for large groups of students who are traveling to Kyoto. And so even in the hotels, you and the way that architecture changes, you can see those layers. And of course, in the course of my research, Airbnb took off globally and entered Japan. And that was very controversial. It was controversial everywhere, but especially in Kyoto, there was so much. One year when I went back, I think in 2017, that was what everybody was talking about, was the disruption of Airbnb rentals and the noise that tourists make, and they don't know how to throw their trash away properly, and how disruptive it was to local neighborhoods. I think Kyoto even put into place an ordinance much stricter than many places have, and then the other ordinances Japan put in place, that the owner has to live within a certain radius of the Airbnb rental. So housing is a constant problem for lots of tourists in the city. But you can see, again, the layers of sort of mass tourism, and then the school groups, and then find your own way Airbnb in thinking about the architecture of the city. That's another example of it.
Yeah, I think you found something really interesting there, because it is such a, it's unusual for a hotel in Kyoto to have so much land, I think, and to be so expansive. I've had an adventure through there, and half of it is a ghost hotel. It's very much Shining and, Jack Nicholson. But I think it was really interesting to read that part there. Perhaps, Ryan, do you want to shoot with the next question?
Yeah, I have a question that I always wanted to ask about something, because so much of your book tackles things that we, as people who live in Japan or are living in Japan, don't really take seriously, but really should take seriously, right? And my question is about the Four Seasons and what we see a lot of expats or people who study Japan as almost obsession and unexplained obsession of Japanese by the four with Japanese tourist industry, not all Japanese, of course, with the Four Seasons. And you do make a good case for taking it seriously. And you show how the season and seasonal-based tourism play an important role in Kyoto. Can you convince me that Four Seasons are important and it's not just a made-up tourist gimmick?
I wonder if
I'm going to get fired from. I'm going to get fired from Japanese studies.
No, yeah. I think that's exactly right. So that's another one of my yes and questions, really, because the seasons are overrated, right? Like the second sakura come out, everything's pink, and all the drinks are pink, and all the candies and the Kit Kats. I mean, it is over the top, especially around sakura and the leaves changing. And yet, I think there is a larger history there that thinks about seasons. I was really influenced by Haruo Shirane's book, The Culture of the Four Seasons. He's thinking about the way seasons work in poetry and literature and some older traditions. So I think both of those things are true. The seasons, I mean, the sakura are announced on the weather report in Japan. So there is, it's not just in Kyoto tourism where there's a lot of hype about some of these seasonal features. I think there is more attention in some ways to seasons in Japan than anything I'm used to. And at the same time, there's, you know, a lot of hype about it, and it is precisely marketed. Just the sheer number of things that are pink right around the sakura time, right? Or ume flavored right before that, right? When the plum come out. But I can list the flowers that bloom when in Japan, and I can't hear because I'm not a gardener. So it's just people tell you, the Kyoto website has, you can look and see what's in bloom when and how full it is. So domestic tourists, I think, do go to Kyoto for seasonal tourism to see. I mean, you can see changing leaves anywhere you are in Japan, right? I mean, the leaves don't only change colors in Kyoto. And yet people do make pilgrimages to see the leaves in the hills, the mixture of green and reds, and in Arashiyama, it's particularly famous. So there are traditions of meisho that I think are being drawn there, even as it's pretty hyped. I don't know if that convinces you, but...
I read the book, so... I'm out of convinced of it. Of course, as a historian, I look always to the historical... There's a reason for those things, for it's part of identity making, in a way. And, for example, sakura, cherry blossom, is a huge part of being Japanese and experiencing Japaneseness, and this has historical reasons. Takagi Roshi have really good work. Do you remember the title of the book, Daniel? Don't remember off the top of my head, but very great work about how it's introduced in the 19th century as an all Japanese thing to experience.
Sorry, it's on that too. I think it's on the two capitals, Kyoto and Nara. So there's a chapter in there on sakura. Yeah, that's right.
So there is a reason.
Sumiyoshi is the main type of sakura. Is more of a like a late Edo and Meiji sort of period thing, but you know it has longer roots. Of course, sakura. Different types of sakura have longer roots in history. Sorry, Ran.
Yeah, no, it's not just not something that has come undisturbed from Heian period to now, and we all experience the same way that people in Heian Kyo experience the four seasons. And there are reasons for it, but you're right, it is more important in Japan than other places.
Yeah. Yes, and I will see that. And certainly in Kyoto, the direct links to the Heian period are always being played out, right? Even though some of those things like sakura come in the Meiji period or in the late 19th century, right? When the nation is being reconceived, right? So that also is history in some ways.
Putting those two main seasons aside, those peak seasons though, I thought it was good how you got into, or you know, the selling of winter and summer, the off seasons, and how the city has tried to do that.
Yeah, you know, thank you. That was
really,
you know,
something they have to sort of promote, really. Sorry.
Yeah, they had to bribe people with hotels during the peak season to get them to come for a while because Kyoto is so cold. It's cold in the winter and hot in the summer, right?
That's right.
Humid.
Especially in Amachia. That's something that's always look really great in the photos, but if you ever lived in one, they're not... climate control.
Certainly not. Not much. And the summer, both summer and winter can be pretty tough. I might switch to the next question here. You pinpoint tensions between the local and the global in heritage tourism, including the slogan you use at the start of the book and I think at the end, experience Kyoto making Kyoto the world's hometown, which I found was quite an interesting little slogan, as well as in campaigns to encourage local people to get educated and to welcome foreign tourists. How has Kyoto City negotiated these tensions, so between the local and the global, and do you think it's been successful?
I don't think it's been successful. I mean, I think, right before COVID and the last mayoral election, I think over-tourism was a huge part of that election. And Kadokawa was reelected, but that was a lot. There was a lot of critique. And around then as well, there were so many national news stories about tourists behaving badly in Kyoto and how difficult it was in Kyoto. In fact, during the increase in tourism over the time period of my book, Japanese tourists were increasing as well. So international tourists are a relatively small percentage of the tourists to Kyoto. And Japanese tourists were increasing during that boom as well until about 2017. So if you look at the city's numbers, starting around 2017, domestic tourists were tapering off. So domestic tourists declined in the over-tourism. And so I think there was a lot of tension about that. There really were. I mean, there's always been a lot of tourists in Kyoto, and it was unbelievable, in some of 2017, especially 2018 and 2019. I did speak with people who were excited about the tourists and thought that even the kimono rental, there would be phases, but people would say, I find it lively and it makes it more interesting. So there were people who really liked the tourism, but I think there were a lot of tensions for the city for sure. And interestingly, there was just an article in, so one of the ways the city tried to handle it was by these really interesting manners posters. So there would be these posters saying, teaching foreigners manners about how to do things, or a sign showing like, don't hit the mica with a selfie stick, or showing behaviors not to do. So there was an attempt to sort of teach foreigners the rules. But I don't think that was very successful. And, as we mentioned, Japan is just opening up again today. And I think everybody's wondering, like, how's that going to go? And just in the last month, the city has put out a couple of new things on their website about behaviors. And their new slogan is enjoy/respect Kyoto. So a lot of focus on your tour will also be better. Your time in Kyoto will also be better if you follow these etiquette rules. And if we all follow these rules, sort of everything will go more smoothly. The other thing they've added that they just rolled out is a Kyoto congestion forecast. So there's going to be a live cam at some peak places like Hanami Koji and Gion. So you can look at the camera on the web and decide whether it's too crowded to go or not. I think I'm pretty, I'll join Ron and be skeptical here. I'm pretty cynical that that's going to work really well, but you can see some attempt to mitigate the effects of just way too many tourists walking around in some of those areas.
I mean, they've had two and a half years or so for people to come up with new ideas and to initiate some of those while domestic tourists have been returning. So it's going to be interesting to see how things develop, especially with Kyoto City facing bankruptcy. There's been the city, the mayor again, has stated that Kyoto will go bankrupt in 10, 20 years if things keep on progressing as they are. And international tourism is seen, of course, as a way to avoid this. So we can see through that, I think, just how dependent Kyoto has become on international tourists. How can Kyoto, do you think, better balance the benefits and drawbacks of tourism in the future? Do you have any other ideas, apart from putting up webcams, for when tourists do return to record numbers? Because it's likely to happen, of course, isn't it, over the next few years?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know if I have any direct suggestions, but I do think being attentive to A, the need for tourists, but then also the ways that too much tourism can be damaging, tourism pollution or over-tourism you hear about a lot. So figuring out how to, I just don't know how you're ever going to control the numbers. And if you can't control the numbers, there's just going to be lots of people around. But the more, I don't know, maybe some human behavior campaigns, right? And getting more people to follow the rules and act properly and just being attentive. So in there was a New York Times article, actually, because Japan is opening, there's all these articles. And there was one just last week that was titled something like, Kyoto wants you back, but it has some suggestions to tourists. And Mayor Kadokawa was quoted in there. And he said, Kyoto is not a tourist city, but it is a city that welcomes tourists or values tourists. So that is interesting because that's very different language than the two strategic plans that I looked at where it really was Kyoto is a tourist city. So I think you've got the city itself has some understanding of the tension. So maybe that'll help.
Yeah, only time will tell because, you know, Kyoto is just not so big, right? It has a capacity that we're almost in capacity right now. So it'll be interesting to see how it works. And of course, again, it's not just Kyoto. I mean, you hear the same kind of stories about Italy and Rome and Venice, of course, right? This is a huge problem. I think we should be thankful there's no cruises stopping in Kyoto.
So that being said, I thought it was interesting in your book there, you showed that still international tourists, even at the peak, were still a minority of tourists to Kyoto, a third or something like that. Is am I right here? Maybe less. The majority is domestic tourists. So yeah, what is the difference between them as well?
And I have to say, even 2 years, I have to say, even 2 years now, I've been coming to Kyoto during COVID, and there's no international tourists, but it's still packed full of people, right? And you don't have those stories about misbehaving Japanese tourists, not because they don't misbehave. I mean, God knows, we all almost get run down by bicycles on a daily basis, right? But I guess they don't put selfie sticks in Michael's faces. I don't know. But anyway, I just want to ask before we finish, Jen, what's next on your plate? What are you working on now? What's the next book?
Yeah, well, it's really hard to be an anthropologist when you can't go to Japan. So, and the book just came out in February. So I think right now I have a couple of follow-up articles I'd like to do. I mean, I'm trying desperately to get there in May or June to follow up, right, and see what's happening and what's changed after the book. I can see a couple articles there. And then, of course, I'm hoping to be involved in the project that you guys are working on dark tourism and think about some of the sites that I'm at, the book is about the big tourist sites where everybody is, but what are some of those erasures in the city? And there's a couple other, like any book project, there's a couple other things that didn't quite make it into the book that might be a good chapter. I've been thinking a lot about the role of photography, especially because of the selfies and the Instagram curation. And yet photography, and thinking about mass tourism as well, you would drive to see a site and take a picture. Photography has always been a critical part of tourism. My own experience of just going to Japan off and on for, I don't know, maybe it's been 30 years. I have the exact same picture of, you know, Kiyomizu-dera from like all these different years, which is ridiculous, right? So tourism has always been a part of going to see places. And I think in some of the trends, I didn't theorize social media or the way that's changed with cell phones. So I've got a bunch of little sort of side things coming out of the book that I think will be my next project to write up. I'm not ready to launch into a new book yet. So
I also just finished a book. I completely understand. All right. So thank you. Thank you for giving us time today. Thank you, Daniel, for joining Kyoto in such an early hour. And I hope to have you here again soon. Not too soon, but soon enough.
Thanks, Ryan. Thanks, Jen.
Great. Thank you so much.